My guest today is Brad Olson, an economist well known to many New Zealanders, and we're discussing the issue of housing supply and some potential initiatives maybe for what we do about getting more young people into their first homes. But I'll ask Brad to please introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Brad Olson, Senior Economist at Infometrics. We're a private sector consultancy. My background coming from Whangarei, moving to Wellington, trying to get into the policy wonk era, if you will, but quite focused on what does economics mean for people at the end of the day? And like you say, what are actually some of the solutions? We often talk about the problems we have in this country, in different groups. I'm quite focused on what does that mean for people on the ground and how do we progress things forward. So, of course, housing, probably the largest single policy issue that New Zealand faces right at the moment. And if you get housing right, you can actually get a lot of other economic settings right. People are able to go to work. They've often got better health outcomes. All around, there are better spin-offs from better housing outcomes. So I'm very focused on not only the problems, but very much the solutions.
Well, that's good to hear. I totally agree. Look, a lot of people, they're in quite a state of despair about the prospects of particularly young people getting into that housing market. But, I can grow up at a time when, the ratio of your income to the cost of a house was much, much lower. But by the same token, my first interest rate was just over 20%. And it didn't fall for quite a few years, in fact. And then I remember being told that our interest rate had gone down to 12.5%. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. But of course now, much lower interest rate. So the question is, is there some sort of a metric there that should make us feel more comfortable? And also, how long will those interest rates, do you think, stay at the levels we're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's probably undeniable that we do have a housing affordability issue, but you're right in terms of servicing a mortgage actually remains still pretty affordable or at least viable for a lot of families. Looking out over the last 30 years or so, serviceability costs, so the proportion of your income that you spend on repaying the mortgage, has been pretty steady. We haven't seen too much of a shift because people's incomes have increased at the same time as house prices have gone up, but interest rates have come down. The difference is that it's now taking people a lot longer to get onto the housing ladder. So the time taken to save a deposit has gone up to about 9, maybe 10 years. And we know that people are taking longer to save that with higher rents and similar. So once you're there, once you've got a mortgage, you're able to look after it without too much of a much difficulty compared to previously. But it is just that you're having to take a lot longer to pole vault onto the bottom of the ladder. Low interest rates at the moment have helped. Now, how much longer will they stay this low? Probably not a huge amount. The New Zealand economy is running hotter than we thought it might have been, so the Reserve Bank's probably going to increase those interest rates, but they're not going to go back to 12 or even 20% or anything stupid like that anytime soon. It seems hard to believe they'll go a huge amount higher than 5 or 6 over the next few years. So higher than the 2.5% now, but certainly not going to blow things out of the water.
Well, even up at that upper level of your estimation, it's still going to be pretty tough for a lot of people who've got big, big, chunky mortgages. And I suppose one of the things that's been interesting is the massive escalation in house price, or what appears to be, over the past couple of years. And that's despite there being the tax arrangements, the bright line test. It fascinates me that, if someone bought a house 12 months ago with an average price and they sold it now, they'd pay that bright line tax and still make a profit in excess of $100,000. It's just crazy.
The numbers are obscene. Just absolutely insane.
And, well, the question is, what can be done to get a better link between the price of existing houses and the price of new houses? So a new house, if you're down on the South Island, you can comfortably get a brand new house on its own land, house and land package, under the 700,000 mark. And in other parts of the country, it will be higher. But on that 700,000, the government's tax take is enormous. There's the GST for a start. There's all the PAYE. Presumably, all the trades like to make a profit. So there's all sorts of both trader and company tax there. What's your view on that? I mean, how much should that translate into? Is it just next time you sell the house, you make a recovery on that? But then, of course, if it's multiply sold, you know,
yeah.
pretty significant opportunities for people.
I mean, there's a lot of money tied up in housing, right? No matter if you're building or selling. There's a lot of cash. There's a lot of zeros at the end. I think what we're seeing at the moment is that there is more of a balance, or now people are thinking much more about do they buy or do they build? And I say that because, you know, a few years back, that wasn't quite the same level of consideration. People are now looking at the numbers. You do often, as a seller, you'll be thinking about the prices that you paid, how much, you know, has gone into tax and similar, and consider recovering that as quickly as possible. So I think that is very well in buyers' and sellers' minds. But given how high we've seen house prices go, I guess the difference is, right, this is an issue that's built up over 30, maybe 40 years in terms of the challenge of finding enough land to build on and what have you. What it also suggests, though, is that there's only so much sort of musical chairs you can play with existing houses. There's only sort of anywhere between 80 and maybe 100,000 homes sold every year. So there's only so much tinkering, I think, you can do on that demand side and how much that will influence the price. At the end of the day, I think it's if you can bring more supply on board, that's going to sort of shift the dial much more over the longer term.
And that's a big challenge, isn't it? And the government's making noises about changing the RMA. We were in government for 9 years, made a number of changes to it, but could never get the support across the parliament needed for some of the big changes that are needed. I think the process at the moment that's been laid out, I should say, by the current government is fairly slow because the need is pressing. But what other aspects of supply do you think we've faced as far as the problem's concerned?
Yeah, I think there's a few elements in terms of both sort of short and long term, because this is about policy, right? What are we going to do about it? And we can moan till the cows come home, but there are challenges of doing a lot of stuff quickly. Everyone says build more houses, but well, we've only got so many builders and we've only got so many materials. One challenge I think we've got that we could solve in the short term is looking at prefabrication or standardisation of buildings in some regard. It seems like every New Zealander needs a very different design home, you know, that has to look unique to everyone else's. That sort of kit set or prefab option would mean that we could build some more of these houses and factories and put them up much quicker than the normal sort of 9 month time frame. It frees up builders as we move along. I think there's also the element of how we free up land. Now, that's been conversations of the RMA for decades. It's been conversations about national policy statements and similar. One thing I think we often get wrong or miss out on with RMA conversations and similar is that it's almost more of an opt-in versus opt-out, is the way I put it. At the moment, one of the real constraints we hear from a number of people is not so much that the planning rules themselves are difficult, but it's that anyone and everyone does object to, you know, a new proposal, a new development, a new bits or pieces. It could well be that eventually those objections are found to not be relevant and are thrown out, but it costs you time, it costs you money. So I almost wonder if you have a planning document that says you're allowed to build ABC, XYZ, it almost needs to be that you've got to lodge an application for an objection rather than an application for building. We've got to, I think, be a lot more free flowing when it comes to freeing up housing and land as we move forward, because that's a key one. In 1990, the cost of land composed about 25% of the price of a house. In 2019, it was 49%. That's just bare dirt underneath. Now, that's silly. It shouldn't be that, you know, when you buy a $700,000 house, $350,000 is just the plain dirt underneath. When your improvement value is only half of that. So it suggests that we've got to get the land element right just as much as we've got to get the building element right.
Yeah, there'd be a lot of people happy to pay that sort of price for a section they could get it. I was talking yesterday, actually, to a property developer. He's waiting for stage three of a development in Canterbury to be approved by the local council. They're having trouble doing it, and has a waiting list of people wanting to get their sections. They've got stage two currently under construction, and people there have paid a deposit but may not get their titles for quite some time because of the slowness of lens, etc. So there's a number of areas that could be sharpened up there, I have to agree. The prospect of being able to increase that supply, considered against the tax proposals that the government has got in front of us at the moment, do you see a problem there?
Well, I think the issue with the tax proposals is it is about that musical chairs element. There's only, in my mind, so much change to demand that you can make for it to be effective. And I say that because, look, there's always going to be people that want to or need to move houses. They've had a change in their circumstances, they've broken up, they've gone to a family, they're moving out of home, whatever it might be. So there's only so much, I think, that you can use that tax lever to shift the sales element. Much more importantly, you can increase the number of buildings. And I say that because, look, quite simply, if you've got two families and one house, what's the solution there? It's not to tell one of those families that they can get stuffed and there's no house for them. It's that you build a second house and make it available. So I think we do have to be focused over the long term on that supply sort of area. How do we build more houses? How do we not only do that, but ensure that the construction sector doesn't go boom bust every 5 to 10 years like they normally do? That was, to be fair, that's how we got into this position, is that after the global financial crisis, the demand for building went down. So did supply. Builders didn't need to do as much. A lot of them went across the ditch because they weren't needed. When demand for housing picked up in sort of 2012 onwards, we didn't have enough supply that was able to respond to it. So at the moment, here in 2021, we're building more houses than we need for current population growth. We didn't build enough for about 8 years after the GFC to allow for that population growth. So by 2025, we might be getting a little bit more back into line. But it does suggest that over time, we've got this issue of how do we balance supply and demand. Now, one area I think we need to get smarter on, we've talked a little bit about local councils so far. We do, I think, have to look at some of the regulations that they have in play and how quickly they might be able to consent and free up land. But also there's that element of how do you ensure that there is actually land to build on? How do you get the infrastructure, the pipes, the roads into it? Because at the moment, local councils have been unwilling or unable, depending on who you talk to build some of the infrastructure they need. They've been cash strapped. And I think there is a real need. We talked about how much money government makes from some of these buildings. You know, a few hundred K it seems at points. I think we do need to consider how much of that can go back to councils to very directly provision infrastructure. We do it with fuel in terms of we have fuel excise duty, we've got road user charges that pay for transport, they pay for roads. It may well be that maybe buildings should pay for more buildings.
Interesting. You're identifying the problem of the slowing market after the 2008 or so GFC. We can't forget, too, that we had 167,000 houses in need of significant repair after the Canterbury earthquakes. And in that number and just above it, about 40,000 rebuilt. So we did have an influx of builders into the Canterbury region at that time. And fortunately, they were available. We also, at that time, consented. Well, I should go back and say the three councils that were most affected by that event had for some years been putting together a thing called their urban development strategy. And it was sort of held up in the Environment Court, not held up for any bureaucratic reason, but held up for legal reasons, that there was a process that had to be followed. We took it out of the Environment Court and simply consented it because the need was urgent at the time. And there were a few people objected to that, but by and large, it created 43,000, or the opportunity for 43,000 residential sections virtually overnight. And the response from the developers and from builders was very, very good. And it's only just in recent times that some of that price stability in Canterbury has been on the rise and joining the rest of the country. I wonder how many councils around the country have done the planning you talk of and just need to get that that simple process to make it happen.
Well, it's exactly. I mean, we're seeing that at the moment with how the National Policy Statement on Urban Development is rolling out. Councils are looking at spatial plans. But also, we mentioned before the RMA. I mean, let's be fair. It's going to take 3 years to come in. It's going to take 3 years for councils to do their plans, and then probably 3 years to go through the courts after that. So it's a long process that is often caught up in legalese and process rather than action. And I think that comes back to some of the issues we're seeing at the moment around councils being able to get their plans in motion, but also to do stuff. One of the reasons we often hear at a very localised level is that challenge of getting things consented quickly. And I think part of it comes back to the leaky homes issues in the early 2000s, because everyone's very scared now, rightfully so in a sense, of having leaky buildings 2.0. And so they want to go through and dot every I, cross every T as closely as possible. Now, I'm not saying that our building code is too strict. I'm just saying that at the moment, everyone sort of has this very fear fearful view, which is slowing things down. And so I think there are moves that we could look at, both on the consenting side and then, like you say, in the planning area, to actually get some of these plans underway. I mean, Wellington's just had this fight, and it will probably go on as well when they review the district plan. Auckland Council seems to be going through it at the moment. Christchurch, I think, is having similar discussions. It's happening across the country. But I guess what we're not seeing is that ability to move things through quickly. Everything still seems to be on a go slow.
Yeah, it's a big problem. You know, the other thing you mentioned there was that the time it takes to put infrastructure into subdivisions. You know, I hate to keep on harping back to the time after the earthquakes, but it was a time when everything was possible. And even though I had to take a bit of a ribbing for being a so-called Henry VIII and just doing things, there was a demand for it publicly and an acceptance of it. And one thing that the Waimakariri Council did, which I thought was brilliant, was let houses start, the construction of houses start on what were effectively just pegged sections. So they weren't surveyed to the point of getting titles. And there was no roadway formed, there was no sewerage in, but simultaneous to the build, all of that work was happening. We used to do that in New Zealand a lot in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s. In recent times, the rules have been you must have a fully built, fully connected, fully titled subdivision before anyone can drive a peg in the ground. And I think it's time just to set that aside a little bit and recognise that there's a massive holding cost in getting to that position that ultimately is borne by the home purchaser.
And I think as well, one of the ways that you can get around that, right, is to ensure that you have councils and developers working much closer together, because one of the issues and the reasons we often have these holdups is because you don't have the sort of staging right. You know, the councils aren't ready with the roads or the pipes or whatever, the developer's ready to go. By the time the council gets around to putting in the pipes, well, the developer's got something else on across the road or across the city. So there's sort of that phasing cost, like you say, and I think if we are going to get back to that model where we sort of build simultaneously, that's fine, but we do need to sort of have everyone working in tandem. And look, I think, to be honest with you, it harks back to when you walk into a council building and say, I want to build a house, you should be welcomed with open arms rather than sort of be rebuffed with reams of paper and say, well, if anything in this bit of, in this ream of documents is out of order, we're going to put a pause on it, we're going to wait, you know, an eternity before we get back to it. That just doesn't seem to be a very efficient way of going about it. Also doesn't seem to be a very forthright way. We've got to be, I think, probably a bit more hands-on to deal with these issues rather than hands-off, everything will work out eventually, because it hasn't necessarily for the last 30 years. We've got to speed things up.
Yeah, it's a bit of a computer says no attitude in some of those places, which they'll immediately disagree with if they hear this, but it is how people feel. On the issue of encouraging young people to get into housing, and the incentives that are available, you've currently got a number of opportunities there. For this, is the $10,000 per head if they've got a certain level of savings in KiwiSaver. What else would be something that you think might work in that regard?
You do wonder if something like build to rent is an option over time, or sorry, rent to buy schemes as well, you know, because people are paying, like I said, taking longer to build up a deposit because they're paying, you know, the rents they are at the moment. If they could be converting some of that rental cost that they pay over, say, 9-10 years into equity for a deposit, that could be, I think, quite an important shift we look at over time. That does require that we have new homes for them to get into. But again, if we're solving supply, we can also start helping people get into those new supplied homes. Over time as well, I think it actually comes back a little bit to the financial literacy that young people have in terms of how do we get them to be saving more. KiwiSaver is sort of a good base position because it allows you to very passively save. You have no knowledge of it. You don't even really recognise it. The money doesn't come into your account. It goes straight off to your KiwiSaver. But I think as well, we've got to consider, you know, not only the usual traditional ways of saving, which is to chuck your money in a bank account and wait for interest to grow. It doesn't really cut it at these low interest rates. And it's interesting hearing a lot more young people who are considering the likes of shares investments to build up a portfolio of investments over time that they can use as a deposit. Now, I'm not talking everyone's getting into Tesla, for example, but sort of more, you know, medium level, medium risk investments. Importantly, I think we've also got to think about what or who's buying. Is it just young people in a normal, you know, relationship, you know, two people buying a home, getting ready for kids? I mean, that is a lot of people, don't get me wrong. But increasingly, we are hearing people that are buying in groups. You know, do you want to get the first home as a group of three or four, get some equity, and eventually you might be able to sort of split that group out? If the deposit's the issue, and we know that it is, it's taking longer to do it. If you cut that time in half, you give people the ability to get on the ladder sooner, they build that equity, they can then go and split out at some point in the future. I think that's an option of at least getting people onto to the ladder. So thinking about those different schemes, who's buying and how can they buy, will be important. At the moment, it seems like if you've got mum and dad that have got a bit of money to back you up, that's important. It suggests, though, do we need to look at something like State Advances Corporation? Maybe not exactly like it, but I know that my grandfather certainly raves about how important that was to get his first home. Is there an option where the government could provide a little bit more just to get you over the line, and then eventually, again, you repay it, you buy the government's share out?
Yeah, look, I think there is a place for that. If you want my personal view, it's not my party's policy view, but my parents, I'm a slightly different generation to you, but my parents got their first home on a state advance loan. And they were, interestingly though, the interest rates that they were charged were around about the 3% mark. So you've got the banks out there, you know, with those low mortgage rates at the moment. And the difficulty though is for young people saving is that while there are low interest rates, if they can get to the point of having enough for a deposit, along the way, they're probably going to be getting at the moment about a quarter of 1%. Now, you know, you only need a two cent rise in the price of fuel, and you're actually into you've just blown all your savings. So, or the value of your savings, I should say. So, it is tough for people. I think there needs to be something in that gap, and we might explore that with a few other people. Moving forward, what else is occupying your time at the moment looking at the New Zealand economy?
I think what's interesting is also how some of the bigger trends in the economy are going to shift the likes of the housing market. For young people as well, we've been talking about that a little bit today. We also know that young people are often getting into relationships, having children, getting married and similar later in life. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic as well, because it suggests that, again, the types of houses that we're likely to need are going to be different. It's not just that we need more houses overall. That's certainly important. But we're going to need, across the economy, some smaller houses, because as we have an ageing, retiring population, people downsize, they're not going to need as many bedrooms, so we've got to cater for that group. Importantly, if we are going to have, say, people who are going to be buying in groups of friends or so, we might need some slightly larger households, at least to start with. So I think we've got to get smarter about that typology. And that becomes important when we think about townhouses and similar. We've talked about densification a lot in this country in recent times, of how essentially because of those high land costs, you can make better use of that bit of land if you build more on top of it. Now, I'm not saying that every part of the country needs a 20-story apartment building. That's pretty absurd. But we do see some quite nice designs coming through for townhouses, 3 to 4 stories. You know, they're not very obscene. They can work well. They're a good entry-level option. But also we see great issues with them often with body corporates and similar high body corporate costs. Some real challenges around those elements. So I think we've got to get some of our settings right on how we deal with denser style dwellings. Importantly though, the real big shift I'm seeing is that we're seeing more New Zealanders move out of our urban centres into our regional parts of the country. That means that although Auckland's been sort of the epicentre for the housing shortage and the focus on housing, other parts of the country are going to see that develop. And if we don't see local government and other agencies move now to think about the regional challenge of building and construction and housing, we could well have a similar sort of issue in 5 to 10 years' time, but not in the metros and in our sort of more provincial centres.
So how do we sum all this up? I mean, it seems to me that central to everything that we've said is good planning at all levels. So it's going to be good RMA stuff. It's going to be good local government planning, their long-term planning. It's going to be taking a different approach to savings products that might be there, and some mix of tax incentive, maybe straight rebate, straight subsidy, etc., for people. Anything else that should go into that mix?
Look, I think one thing that central government often gets challenged with is look, local councils come up with their 10-year plans around infrastructure and similar, but we still seem to have these issues of actually getting infrastructure in the ground. We've got an infrastructure commission which is looking at how infrastructure across the country goes forward. I actually think central government needs to flip that on its head a little bit. Instead of having the infrastructure commission get plans from every acronym government department under the sun saying, I'll build a hospital here, I'll build a road here, I think it needs to be turned around, not going back to town planning days by any stretch, but by saying, giving Infrastructure Commission the power to say, actually, look, we've got a big housing development from a private or a public investor going in this area here. We're going to need some new roads. Waka Kotahi, get to it. Get planning some roads there. Get planning a new school. Please, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Health, we're going to need some new health provision. Because I feel like at the moment it's very hodgepodge. There's a lot of different moving beasts and no one seems to coordinate. We need to have better coordination. I think that's starts with central government, and if you get central government driving in the right direction, you provide the right incentives and cash through to local government, they're going to move in that direction too. It gives developers the ability to develop, and that means that, again, we're on a better path forward. Construction workers have got security of jobs. That's going to help the supply side over time. Like you say, in the short term, as over time, we've also got to make sure that people have got the money to buy houses. That's the demand stuff, and I think there's a real opportunity for particularly young Kiwis to get a little bit more of a hand to get on at least the start of their housing ladder.
Well, look, you lay out quite a significant amount of challenge there. And, you know, I'd say on the issue of central planning, that's something that New Zealand's tried a couple of times, somewhat unsuccessfully. We do tend to like our democracy here, and I've got my own views about the numbers of local councils and whether they're useful or not. But the concept of actually having some kind of national plan is not a bad one. I would just say that the old New Zealand Planning Council that used to exist up until about the early 80s, it might have been, some of the predictions they made about the population, the demographics, etc., wildly inaccurate because it's so hard to predict forward. But I think sensibly you raised a number of issues there that everyone in a policy sense should be considering. So Brad Olson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.